This is tape number 14, conference beginning Friday morning, October 23rd, 1959. Mr. Hillman, Mr. Noyes, and the President participating. Pardon, the continuance of this morning's conference.
This is Mr. Bailey speaking. Now, Bill, do you want to start off, or there's a thing that I would like to...
You got cut off over there when you were asking me a question right in the middle of it, that last question.
Yes, toward the tail end there, we were asking this...
very important question of, well, we were dealing with the role of the Truman grandchildren and what their position in society was going to be, if you had any say about it.
Well, my statement, I think part of it's on the other record, was that all I want them to be is good citizens and do their part in the community, and if the country came to an emergency, to furnish the services necessary to show that they are citizens of the country. I don't care about trying to tell them what they ought to be or what they have to be or anything of the kind. That's going to be up to them. It doesn't do any good for the old folks to interfere in the raising of a family of the next generation. That's the job of the mother and the father of that generation. And of course, grandparents have a special interest in the grandchildren, but they ought to keep their noses out of the raising of the children.
Well, you were referring to that situation in connection with the new estimation you make of men of wealth in terms of their ability to appreciate the lot of those who don't possess wealth and to be able to serve them sympathetically and with devotion.
Well, I was trying to make it plain that conditions have changed radically from the time the country was settled, because the people who came to the colonies in Massachusetts and Virginia and North and South Carolina and Georgia were people who were trying to find a better position for themselves. They were all poor, they were all down in the dumps as far as their welfare was concerned, and they moved westward under the same conditions. People from all those eastern colonies moved west because they thought they could better their conditions, and it became a tradition in America that a man to be in high political office must have come from a log cabin or something of that kind. Well, there are no more log cabins. We've got to take men for what they are worth, no matter what their financial condition or their economic condition may be. If they've got it in them, they can be just as good as the fellow who was born in the log cabin if they're willing to work at it and try to do it right.
Now, in the same vein, a good many of our tourists who are going all over the world have given the impression that we are a rather economically overprivileged and that we are on a spending spree and that we put materialism ahead of everything else, that we show off and spend and are reckless about the use of money.
Well, you know where that came from? It was originated by Richard Harding Davis, who tried to make out that one American is worth a dozen of any other race or creed or color. And we've got to get over that. They'll find that the people of all countries are of the same stripe if they get on and study the thing very carefully. And there's no reason in the world for the show-offs to represent the people of the United States, because the most of the people of the United States are just good, honest, everyday, hard-working people. And when these people who accumulate enough money, sometimes too suddenly, take trips abroad and try to show off, they don't represent the American government, or they don't represent the American people. And I hope the foreigners, the people whom they visit, will find out, if they'll come over here and take a look, that the general run of the people are just as easy to get along with, they're just as kindly, they have no sense of being better than anybody else. Although they want to be in their communities, they want to be honorable and upright and have positions of standing. And if we can get the people in other countries to understand that we're not trying to make a, well, what you might call a whole bunch of show-offs who want to make out like they're better than anybody else in the world, the sooner then we'll have a better feeling with all our allies and our friends.
Mr. President, we have had several succession of generations of different peoples and races who have come to this country, and each have had their own problems. At the present moment, there seems to be the problem of integrating Puerto Ricans. Now, you have had a special contact with the Puerto Rican situation because some wild-eyed Puerto Ricans attempted to assassinate you during your presidency. What do you feel? Do you think that their problems are insurmountable, or...?
No, I do not. Puerto Rico is overpopulated, and some of that overpopulation has been moving out into the United States because they're citizens of this country. And the fact that we set up a self-government in Puerto Rico and gave them an opportunity to do their own developing down there has made them one among the happiest people in the Western Hemisphere. Some of those who have migrated to New York and other cities in the North have found some difficulty in getting along, but you find the vast majority of them are just as good people as any of the other people in the community.
Now, what do you think of cultural exchanges between ourselves and not just the people behind the Iron Curtain, but all nations? Have we done enough of that?
No, but we've been at it for quite a long time. It's a very good thing. As hardly a week goes by that I don't address some students from some other country who've come over here to study in the schools take particular interest in that program, and I find them that they're to be just the nicest kind of youngsters, and they're as anxious as they can be to find out all they can about the country, and that's one of the best things we can do.
You see students from other countries and even visitors from other countries very frequently, don't you, Mr. President?
Yes, very often, at least once a week and sometimes every day.
Well, how do you feel about the cultural development of the United States?
Well, I think it's progressing. I think that the cultural development of the United States is one of the greatest things in the history of the world. It's called the melting pot. We've taken the Irish and the Italians and the English and the French and the Germans and the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Danes and the other Greeks and the other parts of Western Europe and put them together and have made a population which is made up of all of them. If you go back at least two or three generations, you find that the grandparents or great-grandparents came from one or the other countries, and you can't tell these youngsters of the present day from the native-born Americans, and I mean by native-born Americans, those that came 300 or 400 years ago when the first settlements were made on the eastern coast. One of the best things I ever heard was Will Rogers' statement to the DARs that were telling him how many of them were descended from colonial people who were way up there in the economic scale, and that they landed at a certain time, particularly the landing in at Jamestown, Virginia, which was the first one, if I remember correctly. And Will Rogers said he was very happy that that was the case because his ancestors were there to meet him. He was about a fourth Indian.
Well, now, Mr. President, do you think that in terms of our one development, we've had medical development in this country that's been extraordinary. Do you think we ought to do something on an organized basis to share that with the rest of the world?
Oh, yes, I do. I've always thought that. And the rest of the world has things in the same line to share with us. And that's one of the finest things that can happen. But when it's shared, it ought to be shared on a basis where the people that need it most can make the most use of it, and that's not the case at this time in this country. I've been working on that ever since I became a United States Senator from Missouri.
Well, what did you do as Senator from Missouri in connection with...
Tried to get an arrangement made so that the public health organization could be expanded in such a way that the people could have the benefit of all these wonderful things that have been discovered for the prolongation of human life. And what I was after was to get people to set aside a savings fund so they could go to the hospitals on the basis that the hospitals had to have the money to keep running, and that they could pay their doctor bills. That was the only objective, and they had a right to select the hospital, they had a right to select the doctor that they wanted, and yet the American Medical Association got a complex which caused the defeat of that program. And I thought myself that they were cutting off the noses to spite their faces, and they were.
In other words, you didn't interpret patriotism in the sense of acute nationalism, where whatever we achieved and whatever we did was a proud possession to be limited exclusively to the people of this nation.
No, no. In public health, everything that can help the human being to have a better life and to be more healthy ought to be a worldwide program.
Well, you, along with point four and all the other programs of your administration, wasn't that part of the new broad view of the responsibility that the United States felt at the same time that it made these enormous strides for improving the lot of other people?
That was the intention. If you read the message, and the reason it's called point four is because it's the fourth point in the message of 1949 after I was elected on January the 20th, you find that the objective was to help people help themselves. There's no intention to try to make them believe that what we had was the best thing in the world, but if we had something that would help their situation, they wanted to make them perfectly welcome to use it. And that was the objective, and that's the way it worked.
But it was rather an extraordinary thing, even for a generous country like the United States, after having gone through two terrible wars, to undertake a program in face of another ideology setting itself up where it was going to siphon off from other nations for its own development. We were going to siphon off from ourselves and make a transfusion to other nations.
Well, no, not necessarily siphon off from ourselves, because the expense of the Point Four program is very, very small. It only needs instructors to show the people of the other countries who can make use of it, our engineering ability, our ability to organize, our medical background and what we have to offer that will make people more healthy, and our inducement to them to increase their food production and things of that sort along the same lines that we've been able to do it with our agricultural colleges here in this country. It was a matter of information and teaching and health. It didn't have anything much to do with the expenditure of money.
But Mr. President, there was a thing in connection with that, the charity, the care that starts with the charitable disposition to save people from want and to rescue people is what charity normally does. This was an undertaking to improve the lot of people. Now, that's a new philosophy.
That's right, and it wasn't charity at all. It's to help people help themselves to improve their condition, and they can do it if you show them how.
Now, where in the history of the United States was the birth of this idea originated? Where did this start, this interest in the lot and the improvement of other people?
Well, it started, in my opinion, when the settlement of the United States west of the Allegheny Mountains took place. People always helped each other. They were willing to help each other, and the people from the colonies and the states from which they came were willing to help them and help them improve their situation. We also had help from Britain and France and Germany in the investment of funds over here to help the development of the Great West, and that was the idea behind this Point Four program.
In other words, in a sense, it was the philosophy of the Middle West which developed.
That's exactly right. It developed in the Middle West entirely.
And that has become now a permanent feature of the American character and the American outlook.
Developed principally in the Show Me State, Missouri. Missouri helped to settle all the other Western states and made a contribution to them in one way or another. And that's where I got the idea.
In other words, Missouri has been a very fertile ground for that philosophy.
That's true.
Did you develop how did we help in the settlement of all the other Western states?
Their treks to make a settlement, most of them started from here, all but the Mormon trek. It started from Council Bluffs, Iowa, and we sent them up there to Iowa from Missouri. The idea was always to see if there was not something better just over the horizon. And they kept going and finding that place over the horizon. Making the settlement was the first thing you know. We had the whole West, the most prosperous place, I think, in the whole country. And it's growing so fast, I think they're going to forget what they had from the East. Maybe they won't. I hope not.
So, in a sense, the growth and the interworkings of the states, and particularly the state of Missouri, had a lot to do with flowering this whole
That's
idea
true.
Of
all those great trails which took the first settlers to the West, originated right here in Independence, Missouri, and when those people carried their trade goods to the far west and as far southwest as Chihuahua and Mexico, it made a very friendly feeling with all the peoples concerned. And one of the things that we have to be ashamed of is the treatment of the Plains Indians while that was going on.
In that connection, Mr. President, can you recall now some of the things that have guided you and things that you've heard your father and your grandfather and all those that you knew of your living ancestors in their philosophy?
Well, their philosophy was to be kindly to their neighbors, to help them wherever it was possible, and in return, those neighbors always returned the favor when it was necessary. And it was a custom in this part of the world, especially in the big, with the farm owners, to exchange work. And there was no financial consideration in connection with it. If a man had 100 acres of wheat and another fellow only had 40, they'd exchange work just the same as if they were on an equal basis.
And basically that philosophy, you feel, has been carried over into American thinking and American concept.
I think it has. Well, I'm sure it has. If you study the Marshall Plan and the Point 4 program, that's exactly what they are.
Well, now, we've had missions of all kinds. Here. Now, these missions you speak of, as the country moved westward, there were all kinds of religious missions right in their wake. There were economic elements who were working to follow trade. But for a long time, we've been sending missions from the United States all over the world, not only those who originated in the old world, but we started some of our own, like the Moody Bible Institute and those. As against the religious missions or the medical and economic missions, which would you encourage?
I'd encourage them all. They're equally necessary. You've got to have them all if you're going to get a successful result.
Now, isn't there some question, just to develop the point a little, as to whether our right to encroach upon the religious rights or preferences of other people is a good thing or a bad thing from the standpoint of our relations with those people?
It's a very good thing, because we have a lot of Baptist missions in Russia, and we're teaching them morals again, which is what they need worse than anything I know of.
After all, too, Mr. President, we remember that it was Paul on his mission that started the spread of Christianity.
No question about it. Paul and Barnabas' trip to Asia Minor started the thing.
Well, it raises a very important point now, because now we're dealing with an anti-Christ, anti-religious of any kind society that seems to be not only growing, but seems to be attracting other nations, and a lot of their work has been done as a result of exploiting the failures of the church, and particularly the Catholic Church. Now, would you say that this failure of Christianity is in part responsible for the growing success of communism, or temporary success?
Well, I can't consider that there has been a failure. I can't start out with the premise that there has been a failure. There has been difficulties, just like there are with like difficulties come with everything else. But it's my opinion that the moral code of the Christian church is about as good a moral code as there is in the world. Now, there are moral codes in existence in other parts of the world. The Mohammedans are very, very nearly based on the same code that is Christianity. And the Buddhists have a moral code that is excellent, and so have the Confucians in China. But we think we have a better one, and if we can argue with them and convince them that that's the case, they usually adopt it.
But these moral codes have never quite succeeded in preventing a war by a people that practice those. You have it in the Middle East. Even these Mohammedans are, Muslims are very involved in
it. Well, it's always been the part of the hierarchy of every religious organization to be careful to instill into the common membership that the other one is absolutely wrong. There's been more bloodshed over Christianity than any other one thing that ever came into the world. And the Mohammedans contributed to that because they like to fight the Christians, and the Christians like to fight them, which is all wrong. There isn't any sense in it at all. Because when you get right down to brass tacks, they all believe in the honor and the welfare of the individual. And sometime or other, we'll come to a conclusion where we can sit down side by side and let the other fellow do as he pleases. We do that right here in this country. We got all brands of Protestants and Catholics and Greek Catholics and English Church of England in this country, and we don't cut each other's throats because we don't exactly interpret every verse in the Bible just alike.
Well, one of your great aims while you were president, and an aim that you couldn't carry out, was to try to get all the great religious leaders of the world, of the different religions, to adopt a certain common front.
That's right. I wanted the moral forces of the world to make a common front against the unmoral forces. And we got pretty well along with it, and it made quite an impression on a great many of the countries and the leaders of the religious sects in various countries. The people who are most violently opposed to it, but the Protestants right here in the United States.
And they, of course, apparently were afraid of the Roman hierarchy, weren't they?
That's right. That's what the difficulty was.
Would you mind repeating, as I've often heard you tell, the story of, I believe, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, who said that if you would come to his country, you could see the tomb of Christ?
That's right. He said, he was the Prime Minister of Pakistan, he came to see me, and he said if I would come to Pakistan, he'd take me up into Afghanistan and show me really where Christ is buried. He said his tomb was up there.
Now, when you visited the Pope, did the question of universal religion or the bringing together of the religious sects together?
Yes, it came up. We discussed it. It had already been discussed by Myron Taylor, who was the representative of the President of the Vatican, and Myron Taylor had discussed the matter with the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of Chichester in England and with the head of the Huguenot sect in France and with the head of the Lutherans in Holland and in Germany. The Bishop of Berlin, Sibelius, or Debilius, I believe is his name, had the matter put up to him. And they were all very careful listeners. Some of them were not impressed. Some of them were. And then when the discussion came to the head in the United States, the Protestants in this country were the ones who caused the most trouble and who caused its upset. And the effort then was not carried through, but I think it would have been a wonderful thing if that could have been carried through the Metropolitan of Istanbul. Athenagoras was very much interested in it, as was the Pope.
You think that sometime in the future that thing ought to be taken up again?
I think it's going to have to be done unless we want the moral code of the whole world upset by the communists.
Well, are the communists going to sit still for this, or are the communists going to continue to gain in their repressive measures as they have in Hungary and Poland and elsewhere of religion?
I think enough missionaries in Russia, as the Baptists are doing now, will keep them from doing any upsetting, because the general run of the people in Russia are just as anxious to have a moral code to lean on as we are.
Well, why do people need missionaries to awaken in them the natural instinct that they all have anyway?
Why do the Hebrews need prophets to keep reminding them that they'd better stay in the groove or they'd come to a bad end? That's just the human animal right over and over. I don't know why. In the long run, they come to neglecting the very fundamental thing which has made them great. I don't know why that's true, but it is.
Now, you believe that religion is still a very necessary force to sustain the moral and to check the possible tendencies towards immorality by people.
Don't think there's any doubt about it.
Could we?
The great leaders of the world have all been leaders of a moral approach to a way to live, and that's what it amounts to. I had a chance down in Dallas just the other day to talk in a Methodist church on the background of our government and where it originated. And I began with the 20th chapter of Exodus and went through the Sermon on the Mount and showed them where the prophets were all preaching the same thing that we were trying to live by.
But did all of our presidents practice and profess any serious involvement in any particular religion?
Every single one of them belonged to some religious sect in the United States or other. There's never been a Catholic in the presidency, but there's been a man in the presidency of nearly every other Protestant sect.
Who was the most devout president that you can remember?
I can't remember. Most of them had to swear a little bit every once in a while to make things go.
Was George Washington a devout
He was a good Episcopalian, but he knew more words than as many words as any other general that ever commanded an army.
And was anyone ever in the presidency who adopted or who had undergone a change of religious affiliation while in the presidency?
I don't think that happened until quite recently.
I see. Enough said. Could we then get to the presidency itself and what is happening to it during this 20th century? How is the presidency of the United States evolving, both from the standpoint of authority, centralization, and in its importance in our government?
I don't think there's been any serious evolvement of the presidency. I think the presidency's always been just what it is now. And the operation of the presidency has depended entirely on the man who's in there to do the operating. George Washington was the first president, and he had the most trouble, of course, because he was trying to set up a nation. He was the most abused man in the presidency. Well, after his administration and after John Adams' administration, it became perfectly apparent that there was an attempt being made to make a ruling class in this country, and Jefferson overturned that. And then things went along until the financial interests of the country began to feel that they could control it. Jackson took care of that when he came in. And then people began to feel that they ought to have all the authority at home that was centered in Washington, the city of Washington. And that brought about the war between the states. And Lincoln happened to be a man who understood the Constitution and who knew what ought to be done, which the principal thing was to save the Union. If you remember, he said he would be for slavery if it was to save the Union. He'd abolish slavery if it would save the Union. And after his time, the financiers came back into power again, along in the 90s, and the great industrial organizations like the railroads thought they could control the country. Then came along the Interstate Commerce Act and the Antitrust Act, and financial head of the government eventually let the same thing happen that happened in Jackson's time when he moved the control of the finances of the government into the hands of the big bankers. And Woodrow Wilson came along and remedied that with the Federal Reserve Board. And then during the 20s, it went back, and Franklin Roosevelt came along and brought the headquarters of the finances of the country to the Washington, the capital of the government. And these people are on the same line of those who think they're better than somebody else and know better how to run the government than anybody else. So I don't believe in that. I think every one of these powerful organizations ought to be in complete control by the government of the United States and by the government of the various states. And every once in a while, somebody has to come along and wake the country up, just as I was telling you about religion a while ago, to be sure that the government is what they think it is.
Well, Mr. President, there's so much talk from time to time, and certainly has been sharply emphasized from the Roosevelt administration through yours down to the present, of the cost of government, and people are making so much to do about the huge deficits and about...
Well, you know the reason for that. There are a great many people who want to go back to the time of Alexander Hamilton, with a population of about 3,100,000 people in the country. They have the idea that the federal government of the United States can be run at the same price as it was in Washington's administration. I can tell you an example of how things happened. The Secretary of the Treasury in Jefferson's administration went home with a headache and couldn't sleep all night because the country had a debt of $80 million. Well, at that time, when they had that debt, there was about 5 million people in the country. Now, there's probably 170 or 180 million people in this country. And the government itself and the operation of the government naturally grows in conjunction with the population in the way the business and industry and the banks and everything else increase. And you've got to meet the situation. You couldn't run the Chase National Bank in New York on the same basis that you ran the Manhattan Bank back in 1800.